Global poverty is an issue that affects both genders, but due to a variety of factors and limitations put on them, women are often hit harder than men, making the cycle of poverty harder to break.
But our next guest says there's hope, and women around the world are finding new ways of becoming self-sufficient and working to change the often impoverished worlds around them. In a new book, she writes about some of the success stories she's witnessed in her travels.
We're joined now by Ritu Sharma. She's a co-founder of Women Thrive Worldwide and the author of the new book, Teach a Woman to Fish, Overcoming Poverty Around the Globe. Ritu, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, there's a quote early in your book that you get the title from, "When you teach a woman to fish, everyone eats." Can you talk about that quote and how it sort of sets the stage for your book?
Sure. I think we've all heard that old saying, when you give a man a fish, he eats for a day. When you teach a man to fish, he eats for a lifetime. And the reason that I say when you teach a woman to fish, everyone eats, is because women, particularly in poor countries, are usually responsible for the family's well-being, for their children. They have a tendency to share their income. And if they do catch a fish, they have a tendency to share it with their children and with the community. So often we find that when you teach women how to earn an income, you get really remarkable results.
There's a lot of data out recently that if you support women, especially in a family, that you get greater dividends back. Can you explain some of what that is and why it's working that way?
Yeah, for many countries in Africa or Latin America, just culturally, it is the role of the mother to provide for the children's education, nutrition, clothing, etc. And the father's income might contribute to that somewhat, but he's not expected that all of his income will be used to support the children. That's really the mom's responsibility. And so many mothers in developing countries will earn some income however they can to support their children's welfare. So when you kind of make that investment in women, you get a dividend for the family. Now, that's not to say the men are bad. That's not to say that, you know, all these guys that are not contributing to their families are horrible. What we have to keep in mind is that these are very, very different cultures. And the roles of men and women have been sort of this way for many, many hundreds of years. And it's going to take time to change that. And a lot of what needs to change is just men's awareness of what's happening.
It's an interesting thing. It seems as though when poverty comes up and it's approached from the angle, from the perspective of helping women, that sometimes a lot of the time has to be spent talking about including men and pointing out that men are not the enemy here. Men are impoverished and facing obstacles too. Do you think some resistance in approaching poverty explicitly from the perspective of women?
Yeah, and it's interesting. The resistance that I usually run into about approaching poverty just from the perspective of women is from women themselves. I'll just give you some really interesting examples. In Afghanistan, many women there talk about the need to extend, you know, microcredit or economic opportunity programs to their husbands because their husbands are at home without employment. They might be depressed and they might be armed. So it's really not in the interest of a woman, just at a very basic level of safety and security, for our government or others to kind of go out there and say, we're going to, you know, empower women without really addressing the challenges and the problems that men face as well. And what women really want is they would like to have a holistic approach. You know, their challenges may be different than their husband's, but that doesn't mean that, you know, their husband doesn't need assistance as well. And what they're looking for is something more holistic, where they can work together as a family to really lift themselves out of poverty. And what we find is that kind of approach really works, and it's much, much more sustainable.
And yet global poverty seems to hit women harder, and it seems to be harder for women to break out of the cycle of poverty. There are institutional roadblocks. There is cultural issues going on. Can you give us some examples about what is facing women as they try to break out of the cycle of poverty?
Yeah, let me take an example from Sri Lanka. We were doing some work there after the tsunami in 2004, and I went back last year to do some interviews with women about their lives since the tsunami. And one of the things these women said, very interestingly, was that they haven't been able to get ahead, you know, these last 8, 9 years since the tsunami because the government has started taxing basic products like sugar and tea and flour and rice much, much higher so that it could have the resources to rebuild the country. Well, when you think about whose income is really buying those products for the family, that's the woman's income. So tax policy in Sri Lanka has had a dramatic effect on women and families' ability to kind of lift themselves out of poverty after sort of the horrendous disaster there. And we don't usually think about something like that. What was tax policy have to do with, you know, with poverty? It actually has a lot to do with poverty. So from my point of view, it's not just about getting microcredit to women, but we have to build a banking infrastructure. We have to think about tax policy so that the environment that she is trying to progress within actually supports her.
And you talk about also how during the actual event of the tsunami that women were killed in much higher numbers than men were and were preyed upon afterwards.
Yeah, it was just an absolutely awful situation, but not surprising based on what we've seen with natural disasters in other parts of the world. It's a very typical experience that women cannot run as fast in the tsunami situation. Women who have very long hair in South Asia, women usually grow their hair all the way down to their waist, and it's beautiful, but their hair got tangled in the debris and pulled them underwater. Or they were wearing saris, which are impossible to run in when they're wet. Or they were in charge of their children or elderly parents, so they had to stay with them. So for many, many different reasons, many more women and girls died in that tsunami than men and boys. And it created just a horrible situation that, you know, the women that were left were very, very vulnerable. No, without any police force, without any security, they've lost their husbands, they're separated from their families. The men, you know, that were there took advantage of the chaos, and we got many, many, many reports of women being, quote-unquote, rescued from the tsunami but then raped.
And one of the things your organization wanted to do after the tsunami was to make sure that the aid that was available got into the hands of these women. How did you go about doing that, and how has that been working in it as we go forward?
Well, one of the, I think, most important things that Women Thrive Worldwide does as an organization is that we reach out to women after things like this happen because we want to hear from the local women themselves. What's happening? What do they need? What would they like to see an aid package from the U.S. government include? And how can we make sure that the money that our country is giving is really put to the best use? So we got in touch with organizations on the ground less than a week after the tsunami. And one of the things that we heard was that the very small women's organizations and women's networks that existed before the tsunami were not getting any assistance to really help the women in their associations or in their networks. And so we did what we do best at Women Thrive. We went up to the Hill and we took this information to members of Congress and we said, you've got to take about out of the $1 billion package that is going to the tsunami-affected countries, we would like for you to just set aside $10 million. It's not very much, but in the context of $1 billion, but that money goes a long, long way on the ground with local organizations. We said, set that aside and make sure that at least that amount of money gets directly to the women's organizations on the ground that are helping women in their communities.
We're talking right now with international women's rights activist Ritu Sharma about how women are overcoming poverty around the world and the challenges that still face them.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you've worked in international aid, what strategies have you seen that work for women? And what challenges do you think still remain when it comes to breaking the cycle of international poverty? Again, 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Ritu Sharma, the author of Teach a Woman to Fish, about the challenges facing the poor around the world. And you can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think should be done to try and break the cycle of international poverty, especially as we talk now about women and what women need to break that cycle? And have you personally seen any success stories? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And, you know, you write in your book that poverty isn't about having no money. It's more about having no power to change your circumstances. Can you explain about how your organization is working to change that and empower women?
Absolutely. I think what I have found in all the places where I've been and talked to women is that, you know, they understand that their poverty is not just about their lack of income. It's really about their inability to change their circumstances because, for example, they may need their husband's permission to get a job, or they can't go outside of their house without being accompanied by a male relative. You know, they need to begin to sort of build more power and more ability to change their circumstances within their families. And then that begins to expand and sort of radiate out into changing what their governments are doing. And one of the things that Women Thrive does really well is that we work with locally based women's organizations. And I'll give you an example, recent example from Haiti. We were there last year helping local groups that had done a lot of great work after the Haiti earthquake, but they had some issues with how the U.S. government was conducting its programs on the ground there in Haiti, and in particular, some suggestions about what could be done better on violence against women programming. And so we helped them learn how the U.S. government works, how they can talk to U.S. policymakers. We helped them to kind of self-create their own ask, their own agenda for the U.S. government. And then we opened a door for them to go and meet with the U.S. Agency for International Development based in Haiti. And we sat in the back and didn't do any of the talking and let the women really express what they wanted, how they wanted to basically see this aid system in their country change for the benefit of women. And that, since then, we've seen some really profound changes in the way that the U.S. government is doing business in Haiti, and it's doing a lot more to work with and interact with local Haitian women's groups. And that's a change in the system. That's not just a change in a woman's income. What that means is thousands of more women will have access to programs than otherwise would have.
Well, you talk about how it's in the interest of the United States to engage with other countries when it comes to solving issues of poverty and women's poverty in particular. Why do we benefit here in America when we try to do it and extend our reach abroad in terms of solving poverty?
Well, I think one of the most obvious ways that we benefit is from really addressing the immigration problem at its roots, truly. One of the reasons we see people from Central America, from the Caribbean, trying to come to the United States, even more and more children trying to come here, is because they don't have jobs, education, or safety and security. And so if we really want to do the right thing and the solution that will have the most long-term impact, that is to help these countries to develop their economies, and in particular, help those who are poor and very poor to overcome the poverty in their lives. That's just one way that it helps us. There are many other ways. It's a lot cheaper to put a development aid specialist on the ground than to put a soldier on the ground. That's another just very simple financial reality that is important for us to consider.
And you also write a lot about women helping other women. And one group you talk about here is the Coordination Association of Rural Women of La Paz. Can you talk a bit about what that group is doing?
Yes, COMUCAP is their short name, and they are a women's coffee and aloe cooperative in the hills of Honduras. And they actually got started to address domestic violence, and they didn't take on that issue directly. What they did is they gathered women in the community and helped them to start some economic development projects. And when these women began to have some income of their own, they were able to have more power in their household and reduce the violence against them and their children, or they were able to walk away from it. And from that beginning, ComoCap has now really expanded their work, and now they actually export more than 10,000 pounds of fair trade coffee to Europe every year, and they've got a business that employs hundreds of local women in their community.
And let's move on to Nicaragua next. And here you write about the challenges facing farmers, and many of whom aren't the people we think of as traditional farmers. Can you talk about the extent to which women are the ones farming in the world today?
Yeah, I think it would surprise you to hear that 80% of the food that is eaten every day in the world is grown by women. So in most places in Asia and in Africa and even in Latin America, it's the food that women are growing in their kitchen gardens or in their fields that are feeding the family. And a lot of times the crops that men grow are what they sell for cash and for their income. So thinking about women in the context of programs that want to address hunger is very, very fundamental. And in Nicaragua, I got to see some wonderful programs that were really working with women in the community to help them develop sort of a cooperative farming association to grow beans and corn that was actually being purchased by the World Food Program to help address hunger in other parts of Central America. So, you know, sort of women helping each other in their community, but ultimately growing the food that's going to feed other hungry women, you know, who may be just in the country next door. It's a really, really phenomenal piece of work.
What kinds of cooperative farming techniques and policies are these women pursuing as they work together?
Well, one of the things that they're trying to do is to earn enough income from some of their initial farming to buy their own land. That's really critical for women because when they work on land that's either being lent to them or that they're renting, they don't really have any incentive to improve that land. And it's the same as all of us. When we rent a house, you don't really want to fix it up. But when you own a house, you're going to really invest in it. It's the same for farming. And what happens is if women cannot get to the place where they can own their own land, kind of their ability to grow better yields or to have higher quality products is never really going to happen for them. For this program in Nicaragua, that's the World Food Program project, the standards that they have to meet to sell their products to the World Food Program, they have to meet some pretty high standards for the produce, for the beans and the corn. And where they are right now is that the things that they are producing on rented land, they're making some money off of it, but it's not yet the high quality that they have for the World Food Program. So a really important step for these women along the way is to pool their resources and to be able to purchase their own piece of land.
So a lot of success stories there and progress made by different aspects here that we're talking about. But it sounds like you're saying that outside help is still needed. In your view, what do you think works best?
Oh, well, I think it's very, very simple. And we don't do this often enough. What works best is to really start where people are, start where women are, and sit with them and talk with them about what they need and want. Too often we go in with our solution that may be supported by, you know, volumes of data and analysis, and that's good. That's part of the context. But most importantly, women have the best analysis of why they're poor and what is going on in their homes or their communities that's keeping them poor. The most important thing we can do is really go and learn from them and go with a lot of humility and then provide support for what it is that they think is going to be the key.
I want to see if we can talk a little bit now about things that people can do individually. You write that women in America, Canada, European countries, that they have more in common, wealthy women, with these women trying to live on a dollar a day around the world than they think. So what are things that, you know, women can do to help other women if you're someone who has a little more money in the United States, for instance?
Well, I think one of the funnest things you can do and the easiest thing to do is to use your money to buy and reward the companies that are doing good things. I mean, the truth is that we love to shop as women. So let's just use that to benefit other women. And one of the things that I suggest in the book is that when you walk into any store, your favorite retailer, whatever that might be, that you ask the clerk, the associate on the floor, when they say, "Can I help you?" You say, "Yes. I'd like to know if you have an ethical trade policy. I want to feel good about what I buy in your store. I want to know that it was made, you know, paying people well, no child labor. Do you have a policy like that?" And 9 times out of 10, you know, the clerk will say, "No, my gosh, I've never heard of that. I don't know what you're talking about." And you ask them to just tell their manager that you asked. What I would love to see is that if thousands of us women who are out there shopping every day just started asking that simple question, "Do you have an ethical trade policy?" then we will begin to see some of these corporations shift their practices and pay women better wages, make sure there's no sexual harassment in factories, and also begin to reach out and employ women living in poverty, which they could do a much better job of that.
Well, Ritu, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Ritu Sharma. She is the co-founder of Women Thrive Worldwide and the author of the new book. It's called Teach a Woman to Fish, Overcoming Poverty Around the Globe.